thank you for subscribing to Podcast One Premium. He's defeated every champion from every organization the sport of mixed martial arts has ever seen, and retired from the octagon as the biggest draw and the industry's highest paid athlete of all time. And now, Chael Sonnen's on PodcastOne.com. And for that, you're welcome.
What's happening, guys? Happy Friday. What a fun week it's been. You go back to Wednesday, Stipe calls in before he goes and checks in at the fire department. You go back to yesterday, we had Pat Barry and Rose and Brandon in studio before we got into Gilbert Melendez. I have talked to Pat Barry about every hour on the hour since he was in here, and he wants to come back. He said he had so many stories to tell, and he felt he was crunched for time. And with Pat Barry, you never know what direction it's going to go in. I mean, we're sitting down here minding our own business, and he starts telling a story about Melvin Gillard and Rose getting into a fight in practice, and then Pat having to suit up and tag in. I mean, you never know where it's going to go. Anytime it feels like conversation's dying with Pat, boom, he pulls another one out of the hat. So I'm in. Pat Barry's listening. I will get a hold of Pat Barry. We will get him back down here, or we'll have him call in wherever in the world he is. He's out on some expedition right now. Rented some van in California, drove up here to Oregon, did 6 days out in the woods with no cell phone, popped into the studio here, taking the van back. I don't know what Pat Barry's up to, but we will get him back on and get some more of these stories. Guys, a fight was signed earlier this week. And every now and then a fight gets signed and boom, my feathers just go up. I'm a big fan anyway, so it's kind of hard to impress me too much. I'm inundated anyway. But Kelvin Gastelum just got signed to fight Donald Cerrone at UFC 205. Now, I believe 205, fellas, isn't 205 is the Madison Square Garden card, right? Okay. So we should just call it the Madison Square Garden. We should stop calling it 205 because it's confusing people. But that's a very interesting fight. And Kelvin is a big son of a gun right out of the gate, and Donald isn't. When he's at 170. I mean, just right out of the gate. We'll let this thing play out the way it's going to play out. But Donald Cerrone generally has guys that back down from him. They do. He is such a masterful striker. And he'll hit you in the leg, the body, and the face all in the same combination. Boom, boom, boom. He's just guys get timid and scared. Kelvin Gastelum's going to come after his ass. I'll tell you that right now. KG will not be scared. He doesn't know any better. He doesn't know to be worried about. He just doesn't. Take it from me. I've been with Kelvin for a long time. He is going to come after him, and either Cerrone is going to end up with a title shot or KG is going to establish himself in that fight. It's an interesting one. I think it's interesting. Guys, I'll tell you one thing, and then we're going to get right into Nick Aldis here. But look, football is back, and it's time to celebrate. DraftKings is hosting another free fantasy contest this weekend. $100,000 in total prizes is up for grabs. No deposit required. You heard that right. No deposit required. So put your fantasy knowledge to the test and win for free. For free, you're going to get a shot at $100,000 this weekend. At DraftKings.com, DraftKings is the destination for one-week fantasy football. Nobody does it like they do. One-week fantasy means there's no season-long commitments. Play when you want with the players you want. Just pick your contest, draft your players, and follow your team live. Guys, get over to DraftKings.com. Do it right now. Use the promo code CHAEL. And you will play for free. No deposit for this weekend's $100,000 fantasy contest. This contest, in case I haven't made this clear, guys, it's free. No deposit required. There's no reason not to play. Again, use the promo code CHAEL. Get over to DraftKings.com right now. Because this weekend, $100,000 is up for grabs. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website for details. I see Nick Aldis' call. Go ahead and connect him.
The Pro Football 2016 season is underway. And Podcast One Sportsnet's got you covered 24-7. Thanks to Dan Patrick, Rich Eisen, The Stinkin' Truth with three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth, Ross Tucker's Football Podcast. Don't miss a single snap all season long. Head to PodcastOne.com now. That's PodcastOne.com. You're welcome. You're welcome with Chael Sonnen.
All right, guys, we are joined by the GFW heavyweight champion, my friend Nick Aldis. Nick, what's going on, buddy?
I'm good, Chael. I thought I was interviewing you today.
You know what? I saw the tweet go out. We could do a back and forth. Hey, will you clear something up for me, though? I was sitting down. We're waiting for you to call in. You got to clear something up for me. And this is WWE, but who is the champion? Who is the champion right now? Is Kevin Owens the champion or is AJ Styles the champion?
They've got two belts now.
What does that mean?
They're doing a brand split again. They did it about 10 years ago, where they sort of tried to create two separate brands, Raw and SmackDown. And you know, post sort of WCW going under and then acquiring WCW, they sort of tried to reinvent the idea of some competition into promotional. So they sort of do it in house. And they decided to do it again. I think it's just because they have such a deep roster, you know, that they're trying to do it that way. But Owens is the champion, I guess, on Raw, and then AJ now has the WWE title. I forget. I think they've changed the names of them. I know one of them is the Universal title, but I forget. I forget whether they've renamed the other one as well.
And then what, the other one's like the heavyweight title. Okay, but there's still, one of them has to mean more. I mean, I remember back in the Intercontinental days, which I wish would come back because I loved the Intercontinental champions. Even the one stand, right, the Honky Tonk Man stands out. Then the Warrior comes out and beats him. I mean, there was so much there. Macho Man was the IC champ for a while before he became the heavyweight champ. There was so much to that, but we still knew that the heavyweight champion trumps the Intercontinental champion. We knew that. If you're a wrestler, which one of these belts has to mean more to the guys like you, the guys in the back, the guys in the industry? Which belt is more prestigious?
Typically it's whichever one has the more eyeballs on it. So I would guess whichever one is on Raw is typically the one, you know, the one that means the most. I mean, it all comes, I mean, to, well, me personally, I can't speak for everyone in the business, but for me, it just comes down to money. You know, whichever one makes more money is the most important. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right. I mean, there's no way around that. Whichever, and then you've also got longevity. You know, let's say that the Thursday show starts doing bigger viewers. Well, the brand of Raw has been around longer. So, you know, there's something to be said for that, too. So, I mean, it is six of one, half a dozen of the other, but I don't know the answer to it. And for me, AJ Styles is the better wrestler. He's the better wrestler than Kevin Owens. So, on one hand, I guess it's AJ. On the other hand, to your point, I guess it's Kevin. I don't know.
Yeah, it's apples and oranges, isn't it, really? Because, you know, wrestling is completely subjective. It's not, it's not a pure sport. So, it's really... It really comes down to a situation where it all just comes down to someone's personal preference. But I'm with you. I've said that AJ is the best in the business. I've believed that for a decade. So I'm glad that he's finally in a position to be able to really lay claim to that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, in the way he came in, I think it overwhelmed him. I remember when he came out for the Royal Rumble. There is no way Patterson and Vince and Road Dogg and the guys, there's no way that they knew that crowd was going to embrace him like that, chant his name for 30 straight minutes. And when he was over as big as he was, you know, to fast forward, boom, WrestleMania's around the corner. Jericho pinned him clean. That was the biggest surprise of WrestleMania. If I had to lay my money down on one match, it wouldn't have been that, particularly when you take into consideration what a team player Jericho is. Because behind the scenes, right, Jericho's not going, no, I get to pin you, blah, blah, blah. No, right. Jericho would have put him over, no problem.
Absolutely. It's, I can't speak for anyone there, and I certainly can't speak for Vince McMahon or anybody like that, but it's all just a pissing contest. It's just about staking your claim and saying, oh, he's over because of what he's done in the WWE, not because of you know, who he was before. It's always been you know, it's always been their MO to make sure that it's very, very, very rarely does somebody come in and you know, from another promotion or someone who has a strong reputation from another brand and immediately become the top guy. The only one I can think of off the top of my head is really Flair. You know, when he came in 91 or 92, whenever it was.
Yeah. Yeah, and they never buried him. I remember back in the early 90s thinking they would bury him just off of the pissing contest, but they didn't do it, man. He went over.
No, they didn't. And that was it was a great move on their part, because I think that in their mind, I think they realized, like anyone with half a brain in the business at that time, they knew that Flair was he was the epitome of the other side. He was everyone, you know, he was synonymous with wrestling as much as Hulk Hogan was. So to have him come in and be kind of devalued would have just been silly. There would have been no purpose to it. And I think that they realized that by making him the top guy there as well, it was almost like showing, you know, the WCW bookers, like, you messed up this time.
Yeah.
But hey, listen, I'm asking you some questions, okay?
All right, because let's do it.
That's what we agreed, all right? Like,
all right, deal.
I can't get on the phone and just have you just take over like you always do. You can dominate everyone else verbally, but I'm going to have to stake my claim here.
A little bit. You got a deal.
I'm sure that you have talked about it at length already, but for the sake of anyone who may get this through my channels, let's briefly go over UFC 203.
Okay.
Obviously, the first thing that springs to mind for myself, for anyone in the wrestling business, for wrestling fans, is what happened with CM Punk's fight. As much as I admire the guy and I do call him a friend, it was an underwhelming performance. Where do you think he goes from here? Do you think he fights again, or do you think that this is a one and done?
If you were sitting down here and you could see my notes, my next question to you is, where does CM Punk go from here? So we're on the same page. Yeah, so I'll go first, and then I'd love you to weigh in on this. But, okay, let's back up, because it's a long-winded answer. If you back up to UFC 200, you have Brock Lesnar, the biggest draw in the WWE. Right, the once-in-a-lifetime attraction, also the biggest draw in the UFC. So somehow, in this weird and bizarre universe, you got Vince and Dana to get along and go with this. So Dana knows what he's going to get. He's going to get a great night. Vince only knows what could be. If Brock is to have success and then I get him back, what could be? He took the gamble and went with it. So Brock goes right back. It's a win on both sides. Now you insert Punk into that. Because he had the opposite result of Brock, I would imagine that it would slow things if he were to go back to wrestling. I would imagine he couldn't just go back in and have that same allure. I had a little bit different takeaway from Punk, because he went out there and he had such effort and he tried. I thought he was very real the entire time. I thought the only time that maybe went a little back to his pro wrestling psychology or those roots was about 72 hours before the fight. You know, he did some stuff on fight week. He helped to move pay-per-view draws. He put out a storyline that he was 30 pounds overweight, and oh my goodness, the fight's in jeopardy. And he did some stuff to get some people talking. But outside of that, he was just Phil Brooks, a guy living a dream that had a goal and was willing to sacrifice and put 24 months of his life aside and try to climb this, you know, insurmountable mountain of mastering a professional sport at the highest level with no experience. So when he was just real like that, I thought it was helpful to his cause. And then even post-fight, you know, he started giving like this little sermon, and then he even caught himself and goes, I know this sounds a little preachy, but yeah, I'm sticking with it. You know, I had a goal, and people tell you can't do things, but you can. You can do it if you set your mind to. I just thought it was cool, and I thought it was smart how straight he played the whole thing. But
absolutely,
yes, as far as his fighting career, yeah. I'm talking purely drawing ability, like you mentioned earlier with Kevin Owens and AJ. Look, he's not going to be able to draw as big the second time. That's right. A reality, if at all. I'm not sure Dana has him back. You know, there is some commission issues there, and you got to match him up, and there's insurance policy. There's a lot of things that go on that people don't know about. I think that might have been a one and done. And then secondly, I don't know what his relationship is with the WWE, but they're a public company, and the fact that they're suing him, that's a shoot. And, you know, Vince is known for forgiving guys, but I mean, what do you think? Is this the kind of guy where Vince goes, listen, come on back and we forget the whole thing? Is there something Vince can now do with him? Or if he comes back, does he come back to be a jobber? I don't know.
No. That's certainly not an option. As far as Punk and WWE goes, I would be surprised if he was to come back. But then it's happened so many times where people have said similar things and then it's happened. I mean, if you look at the relationship between Ultimate Warrior and WWE over the years, there could not have been more bad blood as far as public sort of defamation on both ways and a complete breakdown of a once very good relationship, and yet he mended fences just before his death, which I'm sure was a good thing in that respect. But with Punk, yes, you're right. There is some legal stuff going on with, I think it's the doctor who he went into some pretty detailed description of some of the practices that were happening there when he was there. He did. If you haven't heard it, he did a podcast with Colt Cabana at The Art of Wrestling, where he over two part episode where he just, I mean, absolutely let loose and just, you talk about a shoot. This was a full on shoot. I believe that's where the lawsuit is coming from. You touched on something there when you talked about Brock. I think the difference, well, I don't know if it's a difference so much as I think that there was much less of a gamble on both ends when it came to Brock's UFC career, and then WWE, because Brock was finished with the WWE much the same way that Punk was. So it was one of those things where I think that because he happened to go back later, that was really a bonus, and certainly from WWE's point of view, I'm sure that at the time when he was fighting in UFC, I'm sure it was really more to do with the fact that it just validated WWE. I'm sure they were happy that he did well. Obviously, in this case, Punk's performance does not particularly validate pro wrestlers or the WWE, which leads me to a point which I've got a bit of a theory, and I want to put this to you.
Okay.
I don't know if this was the case with Brock, but I dare say there was a hint of it when they decided to let Brock fight as well. Now, obviously, if a guy off the street was to contact the UFC and say, hey, I've got no previous experience, I've got no fighting background, I've got really no major athletic background to speak of, but I've always wanted to do this. I want 2 years to train. I want to fight a guy. Give me a guy to fight and I'll fight. They would just say, no, thank you. Go away. But that's essentially what happened with Punk. The difference being, obviously, that they thought he could draw eyeballs. But you could make the argument that there are quite a lot of people that could draw eyeballs. So the question remains, why in particular did they go ahead with this one? Is it because they had a relationship? They were, Punk was a well-publicized fan of the sport. Yes, possibly. Did they know he would be a great talker? Absolutely. Did they think, I'm sure they knew from talking to him that he would dedicate himself to the training and everything else. But I wonder, and I'm not trying to sound like I don't want to go all Jesse Ventura here and go super conspiracy theory.
I love conspiracies, man. You're saying you're the right guy. Let it go.
I know. I do too. Is there a possibility, or is there enough of this in the water supply that from the UFC's point of view, it was a win-win, because they say, okay, we get this guy, and he left the WWE on very bad terms and very publicly bad terms. So it's already a bit of a black eye to the WWE. We can pick this guy up and, give him a fight, and if he wins, great, because it looks like, hey, look what we gave this guy a chance, and now look, he's a way bigger star than he could have ever been before, or at least that's the perception they would put out, and perception is reality, or at least 90% of it. And then they go, but if he gets his ass kicked, guess what? That's great too, because then we get to say, look, this is the difference. You guys are way tougher than WWE guys. And I know that we've mentioned briefly when we talked last time about China. And I know that I've heard you on some other podcasts where you've said, I think that people are reading too much into it and it's too early days to say. But there is a lot going around about both of those two companies really pushing hard to try and get some foothold in that marketplace. And I can even speak from my own experience. I just did a show for Inoki, and they keep sort of blowing me up, like, please hold these dates, to go to China. Like, we've got this big things in the works for China. Everyone's trying to get there. And I just wonder if that's floating into it a little bit as well. And that's where it's getting very conspiracy theory-ish, where they've thought, well, look, we have this guy fight, and he gets his ass kicked, and it's a great way for us to show them, hey, see, here's the difference. This guy was the top guy in the WWE. Look what happens when he comes to us. He gets absolutely annihilated.
Yeah, they're... Absolutely, to everything you're saying. The UFC doesn't go into anything without a contingency plan. I mean, every fight, again, these guys are chess players. They've got to be 2 and 3 moves ahead because they've got so many dates and so many shows booked.
Right.
But they always know, okay, we want to put this guy against this guy. He's going to win here, and then we're going to move him into the main event over here. But they always know, what if he doesn't win? What do we do then? So to your point... Absolutely. They knew it's hard to go wrong with Punk. We're going to look good as a brand either way. We can either show that, we're the sport that offers resistance and competitiveness and look how they do over here, or look, right. we can cash in and do a lot of it. So, yes, that is a reality. As far as Punk's place in this, I don't know if you heard this story, but it was kind of just a place of convenience. The old expression, right place, right time. Punk was coming out. He was being a big supporter. UFC got behind him. They're like anybody that's in the TV business. If they can get a free cameo out of a guy, they're going to take advantage of it. And a Punk moved from the front row seats to the front octagon seat. He was sitting shoulder to shoulder with Dana. They just kind of hit it off as buddies. And Lorenzo leans over to Punk at some fight and simply says, "Have you ever thought about doing this?" And that's how it all happened. And Punk looked at him and goes, "Yeah, absolutely." And Lorenzo just leaned back in his chair, and that was the end of it, planted the seed there, and eventually there was a meeting. So, at some point you had asked, why Punk? There's plenty of guys where you could do this, sideshow, or plenty of guys that could draw tickets. That's true. Strikeforce had done one with Herschel Walker, and it worked. It was this big success. I still remember it. I remember being pumped up about, boom, that's Herschel. I got to watch. I don't care what his skills are. That's Herschel Walker. I like a little of that. Now, from a playbook standpoint, that is the Japanese play model. That is what they have done from day one.
That's essentially who Bob Sapp was in Japan, and and for a while there, Bob was an unbelievably huge draw in Japan.
Huge. They were saying he was the Mike. They were saying, whether this is accurate or not, that he was actually bigger in Japan than Michael Jordan was in America. And when Bob would go to Japan, he was absolutely a prisoner. He could not leave his hotel room. Because couldn't move.
I was with Bob in Tokyo a couple of weeks ago, and he has definitely done a little damage to his rep. With his recent fights in recent years, but I can tell you, he is regarded at this point almost like a statesman. It's just this sort of complete sort of profound respect from everybody.
Yeah, I was over in Tokyo one time. I was minding my own business in a room watching like a Sopranos or some American show that was subtitled over there. But at any rate, there was a noodle commercial. It was for some major national noodle brand, and it was Bob Sapp, with chopsticks and smashing these noodles.
I was going to say to you, have you seen any of the commercials he's done? He's done a bunch over there. He's done one for like a cell phone company, and he's done one for something else. There's one for a pizza. There's one for a pizza company he does where he's dressed up like a pizza delivery man. It was a group of us who went over to Japan. Like we sat there YouTubing all his commercials at once. It was provided us with endless minutes of entertainment.
So let me tell you a story. This is the greatest story in all of MMA. I've known it for years. I've never told it. And why I'm finally going to do it now, I don't know. But it goes back to what you were saying about the CM Punk and... was there a bigger business move and kind of showing up the WWE on one hand? So Dana White really admires Vince. He's always liked Vince. He doesn't always say that publicly. He'll simply say, "Well, I got a lot of respect for him," and that's where he'll end it. But he really does admire him. And the WWE business model is what the UFC copied. And in so many ways that only you would understand if I started listening for the viewers, but the way the royalty work, the back ends work, the locker room bonuses, if you will, all of the negotiations, just the way it works, it's very close to the WWE's model. And Lorenzo Fertitta came out as much as to say, look, we studied everybody from the Yankees on down. It's the WWE that we decided to model ourselves around. So, okay, let me start the story. 2005, they are going to fight at the Mohegan Sun. And the UFC in 2005 used to go their pay-per-views on Friday nights before they have now moved to Saturdays. This was also my UFC debut, so I was there for this to happen. So the week of that fight, this is a great story. I'm telling you, this is the hottest story in MMA, and it's never been told. I'm going to do it right now. So
can't wait.
All right, so here it is. And I got to set up a couple of pieces for you, so let me jump around. Now, at the same time in 2005, the UFC had just broken through. They were in the hole. They were going to sell. They were going to close up shop. It's well documented. They're $40 million in the hole. Ultimate Fighter comes out. It's a huge success, changes everything. Well, at that time, the Ultimate Fighter was on Spike TV. And when it was on Spike TV, it was on Monday nights, and it came on right after Raw. So Vince McMahon called Dana White, and the problem Vince had is that they were advertising the Ultimate Fighter during Raw. So Vince is saying to Dana privately, why would anybody watch my scripted show when they can just wait till it's over to watch your real show? Stop advertising to my audience. And Dana shot with him and goes, Vince, I'm on Spike, you're on Spike, that's where it ends. Who Spike decides to run the marketing and the advertising and to piggyback off of, man, it's got nothing to do with me. And Vince again puts it on Dana and says, do not advertise your show during my show again. And Dana's kind of sitting there shrugging his shoulders going, I'm the wrong guy to be calling. Anyway, okay, move on to the next part. Mike Goldberg. Mike Goldberg is an announcer for the UFC. All he does is announce. Now, in fairness, he's the voice. As great as he is, he's extremely replaceable. So, you can replace announcers, right? And they're only doing 4 and 5 shows a year back then. It wasn't the same thing as having Mike Goldberg go somewhere now. So, the night I was going to fight on my debut, the heavyweight championship was on the line that night. It was Andre Arlovsky. Andre Arlovsky, who is the face of the company at that time because Randy Couture had retired and Tito Ortiz was in this big pissing match. Andre Arlovsky's the new face. He's selling all the tickets. He's doing absolutely everything. He's going to get $18,000 to show and $18,000 to win. Now, there wasn't really sponsors back then. There was definitely no fight of the night or backdoor or pay-per-view bonus. None of that even existed. So he's looking at 18 and 18 to headline a card with the biggest prize in all of sport. That's extremely relevant to this story. That week, Vince McMahon contacts Mike Goldberg, and he tells Mike Goldberg, I will give you $100,000 to no call, no show the UFC on Friday.
What?
So Goldberg doesn't get to warn anybody. He just can't show up and he can't call in and warn. He just needs to stick them without an announcer. Goldberg does the right thing, and the very first person he calls is Dana. And Vince tells him, this call never happened, and I will wire you this money on your word. And Goldberg calls Dana and says, here's what just happened. So Dana not only gives Mike Goldberg a brand new $500,000 contract, but right then realized, if he's willing to pay $100,000 for my announcer who is replaceable, and I'm only paying my main event 18 and 18, I got a problem. This is a level of thinking, of strategy, of business play that I'm just not ready for. And don't forget, Dana White's only like 45 right now. So in 2005, I mean, he's a young guy. He's 32, 33. He's still trying to figure the world out. And he realizes right then, this is tough. This is a level of thinking that I'm just not competing at this level right now. Not only did Goldberg stay, not only did the business change, the Ultimate Fighter never played Monday nights again. The Ultimate Fighter moved to Wednesdays and has never gone back.
Wow.
That is the number one hottest story in the history of MMA, and it has never, ever been told, and there it is. So when you ask me, are they thinking about the WWE? Are they thinking about ways that it puts them over, even in a worst-case scenario? Absolutely.
Yes. And look, you can be as successful as you want, and the competitive nature of some people never changes. I've always heard that about Vince McMahon, and I'm sure the same is true of Dana. And I mean, if that's true, if that story is true, and those and things are operating on that level back then, that's a grudge that doesn't go away. You know what I mean? That's something that you don't forget very quickly. So with everything that's transpired before and since, I mean, you have to think that there is always, I mean, there's no two ways about it, Chael. They stole a big chunk of the WWE audience. I mean, they didn't steal it. They acquired it, you know? And for as long as many people in the business can like to give these sort of stock answers, like, oh, you know, they're two different things. You know, we're not competing. We're competing with everything in entertainment. You know, yeah, that you technically are on the same way that everything is technically competing with everything on television. But let's be real here. Your demos are exactly where they want. You know what I mean? And frankly, that coveted 18 to 34 male demo made a choice. You know, somewhere around 10 years ago, it started, and now it's well and truly entrenched in the UFC camp.
Yeah, it definitely is. You know, they say at the UFC, and I don't know if this number is still true. This dates back a number of years now, but they said it was 4-1 WWE. Whatever we do, they beat us 4-1. They've got 4-1 fans. They've got 4-1 passion. They got 4-1 Google searches, all the different metrics they follow. And it particularly, and this is something that really nobody's been able to tap into, but is merchandise. The business.
The licensing is fantastic.
It's huge. Oh man, I would go to these shows, and you know the wrestling fans, you know, they're just what the stereotypical fan used to be, right? They don't have a ton of disposable income, but man, if wrestling's coming to town, they're coming. And the lines, Nick, the lines at the merchandise booth, it was unbelievable. And they weren't cutting them any breaks, man. I mean, it was $100 for the replica belt. It was $30 for a shirt. It was $25 for a pull. It was not cheap. And these fans, it did not matter. It didn't matter if they were going to have to go hungry the next day. They were leaving there with something.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the exact numbers, but I remember talking to one of our merch guys, our licensing guys, and he said something to the effect of the average concert, you know, live sporting event, or everything that falls into that kind of bracket, the average take for merchandise is something like $10 per head, but in wrestling, the average take is $40 per head.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so even with TNA, which was operating on a much smaller level than WWE, you know, especially with the live events, like that was really was a huge lifeblood of their, you know, revenue. While we're talking about the UFC and the WWE and MMA and pro wrestling and the choices between the two, you know, you've mentioned something to me a couple of times and you've touched on it. And I apologize if you've told this story before or gone into more detail, but you mentioned that you tried out at the power plant, right?
Yes.
Well, so where what's the rest of that story? You tried out, and so what was the outcome, and where ultimately did the decision take place for you where you said, I'm not going to pursue pro wrestling, and when did MMA become the focus that you said, okay, this is where I can, you know, this is what I want to do now. This is where I make my mark.
So it was this was in 1998, and when the Monday Night Wars were going on, the WCW would advertise, hey, you want to be a pro wrestler? Call this phone number. And they had like a commercial that they would air. And so I finally called the phone number, and it was real simple. You went out to Atlanta. I don't think it cost anything to try out. You just had to get you had to pay your own way out there and do that whole thing.
Right.
And so I get out there, I went in summer of 98, and I was in very good shape. I was an All-American that year in wrestling, and the reason I bring that up is I was in really good shape. I was in great. Nick, it was so hard, and the way it worked was, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do 25 push-ups, 25 sit-ups, and 25 squats. That's all we're going to do. But we're going to do this for 8 hours, and when you've had enough, just leave, but do not come back. And the do not come back actually had a little fine print, like you could come back, but you had to wait 12 months. There was a way you could try out again, but basically, man, that this was your shot. And Sarge ran it, and the day I started, there was 12 guys. And we were going to do this, 25 push-ups, 25 sit-ups, and 25 squats. We were going to do that for 8 hours for 2 days, and then the third day was a half day. So at any rate, that's all we're going to do. And I remember you could cheat on your push-ups. What they'd yell at you, but you know, however a push-up goes, a sit-up's another one where you could do a lot of, but the squats. Sarge brought out 5 gallon buckets and he turned them upside down. And when you did your squat, you had to come onto your toes. You had to throw your hands up in front of you and your butt had to touch that bucket.
Right.
And we did so many squats that little tiny lip of the bucket when it's upside down was cutting into my legs because I didn't know where it was. It's behind me.
So you just
know to go down till you hit it. We did so many, it was cutting in. By the second day, there was 3 of us left. And that was more like by the second hour, there was 3 of us left. But by the second day, there was 3 of us left. There was me, there was a gentleman who was a cop in Georgia, and there was another gentleman who came in from Jamaica. By the third day, it was still the 3 of us left, but the cop did not get in the car in the morning and come over. He just couldn't get out of bed. And I know what that felt like. I was Epsom salt baths. I was doing, man, I had never felt this way. And I was in really good shape at that time.
Yeah.
So the second day ends and Sarge takes us out in the heat of Georgia. And all we did was the push-ups, sit-ups, and squats. But on the third day, we had to run sprints. And it was just right there in the power plant parking lot. Sprint down to one side, catch your breath, sprint back to the side. Sprint to the other side, and he just ran sprints hoping one of us would quit. We both hung in there. Now, at that time, and this is relevant, is that's when they were kind of introducing the cruiserweight. Your stars of AJ Styles, of Chris Jericho, of CM Punk, that was not happening back then. But they did have the cruiserweights, and they were telling me, look, you're probably going to have to be a high flyer. I was weighing 196 pounds.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted to be Hulk Hogan, right? I wanted to be Stone Cold. I didn't really want to do that, but okay, fine. If that's what I got to do, then I'm in. I had 2 years of college left, so I went back. I finished college. By the time I was done, they were out of business, and I simply did not know how to get a hold of the WWE. We didn't have, you know, Twitter wasn't around. Facebook wasn't around. Tracking down phone numbers, you had to be a detective to do it. People were just getting into email. I simply ended my pro wrestling dreams because I didn't know how. I didn't know who to call.
So in your mind, it was like, I'm going straight to the big time, that you didn't think about doing like independence and getting seen that way.
Or even know how. I didn't know how to. Now, looking back, I was 21 years old. Looking back, of course, I could figure that in 5 minutes now. I could give somebody else advice. Let's jump on a phone. Let's call Nick. Nick can give us a number. Now I know people. But back then, no, I didn't know how to do it. And we had a hot little scene in the Northwest. We had Don Owen died and things changed. But, yeah, we had huge stars. You know, I could go through the list from, well, Ric Flair came through the territory, but Snuka got his start out here. Piper got his start out here.
Portland was one of the big territories.
One of the best workers on the mic of all time. I hope you're familiar with him, but his name is Len Denton. He wrestled under a mask as the Grappler. I would put him head-to-head with anybody, including Stone Cold, interview for interview. One of the best ever.
Stone Cold is a big fan of Len Denton. He's mentioned it many times.
I see Len all the time. He works at a Home Depot around here. He doesn't wear the mask. He works out at the gym every single day for about 5 hours. Doesn't work super hard, but he's in that gym about 5 hours a day every day. It's his hobby. He's never not there.
Yeah. How do you think? So, because that's the thing. When you told me the time frame and you would give me and you said it was a power plant and this and that, and I thought to myself, the one thing that would have really been an issue back then would have been your size, because it was still very much, even though obviously everyone's size was greatly embellished, it was still, you know, it was still a good, you know, 3 or 4 years before there was a good number of those guys who were sort of like the Guerreros and Benoits and Jerichos and stuff who were really given their due. And it probably would have been tough for you in that respect, given how you saw yourself. But ultimately, Chael, you know, it's obvious when you look at your career in the UFC that had you been given the opportunity, which is really ultimately all it comes down to, you would have, I mean, I do believe that you could have taken the ball and run with it, but at the same time, timing is everything. And in many ways it worked out better for you because the UFC overtook WWE in terms of pay-per-view buys and live event attendances. And you were, you know, for a time you were the highest paid guy in the UFC, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I had my window. Yep.
Yeah. And so in that respect, it's like we talked about the last time we spoke. In many ways, you were fortunate because instead of being one fish in an ocean full of guys who could talk and were all trying to make their money that way, you suddenly became the one guy, or at least one of only a handful of guys in the UFC, certainly the best guy at it, who could talk people into the building. So in many ways, your pro wrestling sort of interest and even sort of brief flirtation with the business set you up for ultimately your success in MMA.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. I think being a fan of wrestling and of the psychology and really studying it, I think that did help. And to your point, yeah, I would have just been one of the guys in wrestling. But, you know, you take that. There's some baseball player, and if I could produce his name right now, it would help my story. But a couple of years he came out, he started doing crazy interviews, and he grew this weird beard. And
oh, yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah.
He really wasn't a very good interview, and the beard wasn't all that good of a gimmick. But in that space, it absolutely was. I mean, I remember John McEnroe from tennis. You know, he was just a dick with an attitude. But in that space, he's still the legend. Nobody's even touched him. Now, if he would have come over to pro wrestling, he'd have just been a guy in the back.
Absolutely. Well, everyone had just said, yeah, it's par for the course. You know, it's like anything. It's absolutely, you know, it's about what you present in your environment compared to your peers. I mean, we talked about that before. Where, you know, when I did Gladiators, like no one else really wanted to talk, and I was like, I'll talk. I'll be the villain. And they were like, oh, thank God, we didn't think anyone wanted to do it. And then when I did it, you know, suddenly within a few episodes, everyone was trying to do it. And of course, by then, you know, it was too late. Like, I was the guy who was known as the bad guy. So hey, let's switch gears.
Okay.
Again, I know you've been. I'm sure that you've talked about this a bunch, and I heard you talk to Ariel Helwani about it a little bit, and this and that. But where are we at with a potential Chael Sonnen return? You got your USADA results back.
Yes.
And where do we go from here?
So okay, so I had so yeah. So the way USADA works, you got to jump into this pool. I believe it's a 4-month pool, and there's room for exemptions and how all of that stuff. I ended up in the pool. That's what I can tell you. Everything went fine. I was tested 4 or 5 times, and man, the best I can say is I'm working on it. I'm in the gym every day.
Yeah.
I'm in the pool. I got my weight down. Yeah. I got so big for a while there. I couldn't even finish a workout. So anyway, I got my weight down. I've been getting in shape. I've been in the gym, and it's going okay. I can't tell you it's going great. I'm having some great moments here and there, but overall, after I spar for the day, it's going okay. But it used to not be okay. I started it bad. I started where I couldn't finish a workout, man. It turned into this thing where I just had to start taking baby steps, and getting my weight down changed things a lot. So I'm spending some time in the college room. We got a college out here called Clackamas Community College, one of the top programs in the country with one of the top coaches. I'm spending some time with those guys and just trying to get my minutes in and pay my dues. Right. For a while there, Nick, it wasn't an option. And whenever I would dance around it, it looked like I was trying to be the guy with some secret. No, if I'm coming back, I'm coming back. But the truth is, I wasn't in a position to, man. I was sitting on a suspension. Boom, I get done with the suspension. Right. And then all of a sudden I find out about this USADA pool. Well, that adds another X amount of months, and you got to get in it. You got to comply, and then you got to get a contract and a date and a post. So there was just a lot of moving parts. It wasn't as simple as me going, I'm in. And at one point in my career, it was as simple as saying, I'm in. But it's not like that anymore. Now there's a lot of formalities and stuff you just have to go through. So I'm starting that process so that it at least becomes an option to where I can go, boom, let's do this, or no, I'm not going to do it again. So that's where I'm at. I'm in practice every day. I haven't missed in a meaningful period of time. I'm on track to be able to raise my hand and say, put me in, coach.
Yeah, at middleweight again?
I think I'd like to go back to middleweight. 205 is a lot more fun, just because of the pain of cutting weight. But I think that middleweight's probably the place to end up. It does come down to, you know, where can you get an opportunity? Where can you fill in? For a while there, I thought about going up to heavyweight, just because they moved a little bit slower. So every now and then, your mind plays tricks on you. But ultimately, you know, I'll sit down with
heavyweight. Man, oh man.
Yeah, I thought that I didn't stay with that flirtation very long, but I did think about it. But you know, ultimately, I'll talk to Coach Clayton. I'll see what he thinks. He'll probably be the one that decides the weight class, right, and then go from there. That was a really long answer to your simple question, but
it required a long answer. I understand. While we're talking about the heavyweights was the sort of focal point of 203. I've got to ask you about this because admittedly, I'm a big fan of MMA, but I'm certainly not an expert on it. I have no, you know, very little experience in martial arts or anything like that. So anything I know is just through, you know, absorbing what guys like you or Rogan or different people have to say about it, and I take it and try and process it. But there was something odd to me about Overeem's performance against Stipe. Like he's one of the deadliest strikers, like, in heavyweight history. I've never seen him take a walk like that. Like, what was going on there? Am I seeing something that no one else is seeing? Because I was watching it going, like, who is this guy fighting Stipe? Because it looks like Alistair Overeem, but he's not fighting like him.
See, I appreciate you saying that. I did a show on this a couple of days ago, and my buddy Joel jumped on and said, that was one of the greatest fights in heavyweight history. What a round. And I was kind of scratching my head going, it was entertaining, but it was weird. It was a weird fight. Yeah. And the way Overeem was like turning away, and at one point he even ran to create some space. And I get why you would need to do that. But to your point, not with Overeem's skill set. Overeem's the guy that wants to stand right there and start trading and hope he lands that big, powerful shot. So I thought it was just a really weird match. And, you know, Overeem did have that hope spot. He put him down and then he went into that guillotine, and I thought he was going to finish that. Overeem's guillotine is legendary, and he put it on a hurt, you know, disoriented Stipe. So I thought, yeah, as far as a hope spot went, and then, you know, when he did finally stumble to the ground, it's kind of a weird takedown. Stipe made the most of it, got him down. Overeem, he just kind of sat there. He didn't really move, and you only have that millisecond to either scramble and get up, or you're going to get caught. And he got caught. See, I'm with you. I thought it was a weird fight as well, and I've never really seen Overeem fight that way.
I was watching it, and I'm not that familiar with Stipe. I want to go back to that in a second because I wanted to ask you about this. It's something else that I've noticed from a business standpoint with UFC, but. I was watching, you know, one thing I noticed was Stipe's head is gigantic, and that I don't know whether that has it. I mean, it had to be hard to get a guillotine on the guy because his head's like twice the size of Overeem's.
Sure.
But, I'm looking at it and I'm going, well, obviously, like, Stipe's a boxer. You know, you can see that from watching it. He wants to stand and throw hands. But it was weird to me because I said, Overeem's almost fighting like he was hurt. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't know whether it was something where he had an injury and he just didn't talk about it or what, but I was like, he's fighting like he's hurt and he's trying to regain his composure or something. And I just couldn't, I've seen quite a lot of Overeem's fights and I've never seen him fight like that. But, I'm glad that I'm not completely crazy then, because we were all sitting there and, you know, a bunch of us were watching it. I was watching it with Mike Knox and a bunch of other guys, and they said, who do you think? And I said, I think Overeem might take this because he's such a good striker, you know. And then it just sort of out of nowhere, like, he's got him down in his guard, and then suddenly just like wham, 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 and he was done. And I just sort of scratched my head and went, that was a weird fight. But let me ask you about this too. I've got something I think UFC does incredibly well, and this is something that I don't think that they've borrowed from WWE. I think this is something that they've a skill that they've developed on their own as far as business. that you've mentioned it before. I've heard you talk about it, where you've said that the knock on the MMA business model from people in the sports entertainment model was always that the trouble is there's a vulnerability there. It's hard to build stars because you can't control the outcome. And you can have all of your eggs in one basket, like a Ronda Rousey or a Conor McGregor, and they can get beat. You know, and then suddenly, where do you go from there? Well, clearly, obviously, the model has shown, well, where you go from there is the guy that beat them. Now you've got another star, you know. And as long as the shine doesn't come off too much off the guy that lost, you've still got the value there as well. Obviously, you're an example of that with your first fight with Anderson as well. But one thing I've noticed they do, or at least it looks like they're doing to me, is that so. With Stipe, obviously, they booked the show in Cleveland. Smart move. You know, it's a huge sports town. The event sold out in like a day and a half. They did a massive gate. But to me, see, the at least from a layman's point of view, the focus, most of it, as far as the mainstream is concerned, was on CM Punk. So they're trying to get the eyeballs, you know, they're trying to use Punk to try and draw a slightly different audience and get more eyeballs in it and get that kind of sideshow element to do the draw. But they think that the idea that Stipe was the main event and booked as the top guy, despite the fact that he really hasn't, you know, prior to that event was not, to me, or at least in my memory, sort of pushed as like a big UFC star. Suddenly he's a big UFC star, and they do that very cleverly because they put all the attention on someone else who's established, so that then when the time is right, the event comes away and it looks like this guy stole the show. Do you see any element to that, or am I just looking too much into it?
I do now that you say it. I think that you just spelled that out pretty clear. But yeah, and that's always been one thing that I've disagreed with MMA, and not strongly. I'm not passionate on this, but when I do get something where somebody says, "Hey, Cheryl, what would you change?" I always think the biggest draw should be the main event. And you know, again, that comes back to Vince. If it's WrestleMania, it doesn't matter if the belt's up or not. Whatever everybody's coming to see is going to close the show. And I've just always thought it should be that way. For this situation, yes, they were in Cleveland, but you're still in the pay-per-view business. People were tuning in to see CM Punk. So I've always just thought that should close the show. Now, they did change that a little bit over time, the UFC. If it was a title fight and there was only one on the card, that was going to be the last fight of the night, the end. That ended with Conor McGregor. Conor versus Diaz, part one and part two would be a great example. There can be title fights. There can be whatever you want to go on.
Right.
Those guys are closing the night out. And I've always thought it should be that way. Your main event doesn't always just have to be a tip of the hat to the champion or the most successful man. There's a lot of champions don't draw. And if I'm the promoter and he's not drawn, I'm not putting him on the marquee. I'm just not. Right. That marquee's only got space for two names on it, and I'm putting the ones that are bringing the eyeball. So, you know, I have thought about that. If there was any change, I would consider that one if I was at the UFC.
So just spell it out to me again. You'd consider making it where the fight that draws is always on last rather than the title fight?
That's what I would do, yeah. You know, yeah. You have
so you think that you're saying that you might have booked Punk's fight to go on last?
I think I would have booked it to go on last, yeah. And maybe wow. That's not the best example, but in some situations it is, which again we saw with Conor versus Diaz parts one and part two. But that's right. Kind of been the anomaly. If somebody has the belt and there's only one belt up, they always go on last. That's just the UFC model. They believe it's a respect thing to their champion. I get all of those things. But, you know, when you're Punk and you're driving the media, there was nobody that did as much media as him. ESPN covered this. They did six different segments. They were dominated by CM Punk, and then they would close out by going, and the heavyweight championship. Make sure you stick around for that, too. But it was just...
Well, he had his own show. I mean, he had his documentary series that was like four or five episodes, which, by the way, ran on Monday nights.
Yeah, well, it did run on Monday nights. We'll see if they get a phone call. But see, that's exactly right. Is you know, when one guy steps in and takes it, particularly the way the pay structure is set up. I mean, they're all in on it together. It's the same as the wrestling business. Whatever gets the most eyeballs is what the guys are going to go along with. Punk drove the eyeballs. He brought in the pay-per-view. That's just the reality. what do you do with your heavyweight championship? You don't want to disrespect them. I understand all of that. But as a long-term play, you know, maybe not this week, and maybe isn't the best example, but as a long-term play, I like what Vince does at WrestleMania. Whatever the biggest draw is, regardless of what trophy's up, whatever the biggest draw is going on last.
Well, that's not always technically true, though. I'm just thinking about the one that stands out in my mind. It's usually true, but there have been moments. The one that stands out in my mind, there are two, actually. WrestleMania 18 and 19. So 18, the main event of 18 was Jericho versus Triple H, because Triple H had torn his quad. He came back at the Rumble. He looked incredible. He came back as a babyface. It was really the first time he'd been a babyface when he was a top guy, and he chases Jericho for the title. Jericho has Stephanie, in his corner, as a heel. On paper, or any other time, it would have been a huge angle. And I feel like it would have done very, very well and not been underwhelming. However, there was another match that was booked on that. Well, there were two other matches on that WrestleMania 18 card. One was TLC 2, which was unbelievable, an absolute sort of groundbreaker and be remembered for always. But most importantly, there was another match booked on that 18 card, which happened to be The Rock versus Hulk Hogan, nobody's following that. They had Austin and Scott Hall on that show, which I personally was like really looking forward to because they're two of my absolute favorites of all time. And I was like, man, that would be I just thought that'd be such a great matchup. But the whole, you could just tell from the minute that pay-per-view started, you could just tell that everyone was saving their energy for Hogan and Rock. And then when it happened, it was just a moment in time. Like it's up there with, I mean, honestly, Hogan has more of those moments than anyone else in the business, which is why he is who he is. And then the following year, Hogan kind of stole it again because the main event of 19 was Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle, which was obviously it was a really beautiful technical match, in terms of wrestling, it was a real masterpiece, as far as like they really incorporated a lot of amateur stuff into it. And it was a really, very, very technically, physically beautiful match to watch. But it was marred by Brock going for the shooting star press and landing on his head. He's lucky he didn't die. But the other match on that card that ended up being that went on the cover was Hogan against Vince.
Yep.
And so even though they weren't on last, I get like by the time those DVDs were marketed, because that was still, we were still in the DVD era then before everything was on demand. Those two, if you go back and look at the artwork for WrestleMania 18 and 19, now they're both Hogan's matches, even though they weren't on last.
Yeah, so, I went to that.
But what you're saying is, and you're right, is that they acknowledged which match was the match. But yep. I don't know that necessarily that is the right thing to do, because looking at how 203 panned out, I would suggest that UFC probably did the right thing, because here's why I started seeing this. Obviously, I try to be as observant as I can with this stuff, particularly on a business level. But I was watching the Embedded. I love the Embedded shows they do on YouTube. Sometimes they can be a little dull if they don't have, particularly good, charismatic guys, coming up. But most of the time, I really enjoy those Embedded videos they do. And by the time those Embedded things were done, I was like, I really like this Stipe guy. He's really cool. And I suddenly went, holy shit, I just got worked. I was a complete mark. I just got completely worked by the UFC, and I suddenly went, that's exactly what they were going for this whole time. Because you're watching it going, because if you look at the screen caps, the freeze frame they used to sort of the still they used to show the YouTube video, they're all punk, or almost all of them are punk. But when you watch them, a great deal of the time is dedicated to Stipe. And, and they're showing how he's a part-time firefighter, and he's a super charismatic guy, actually, behind the scenes. I was really impressed with how he carries himself, and, seems like a really genuine, like, gregarious guy. And I suddenly went, they want to run with this guy. They want to rejuvenate the heavyweight division, and Stipe's the guy they want to do it with, because he's huge in Cleveland, and he's, like, got this big personality, and he's a... You know, he's got a great, he's Croatian, so it's a different, you know, it's sort of Bruno Sammartino thing where you can sort of get the immigrant kind of following. And I was like, he's a star to build around. And I said, that's genius. That this is very calculated.
Yeah, and you know, I love those embeds too, because there's nothing better than being on the other side of the curtain, seeing how the guy really works, seeing what it takes to be the guy, seeing what he does. I had Steve on a couple of days ago, and you know, I don't even like to reach out to a guy when he's post fight week, but look, I'm after ratings. I got to get these big names on, so I bother Steve. Boom, no problem. I'm on. And one of the things I asked him, and I don't know if you know this about him, but he is a fireman. He works in the Cleveland Fire Department. And I said to him, you know, what's this like now that you're the champion and you're on fight week and you're down a little bit and you're banged up? You know, what's your schedule look like? And he said, well, I got to go in today for a couple of hours, but I'm not officially on the schedule till Thursday. He just said it as calm as that. And I'm going, okay, you're going in today and you're on the schedule, meaning you could answer the call if all hell breaks loose on Thursday. And he's like,
oh, dude.
Yeah, Thursday, 1 o'clock.
I mean, talk about a baby face. Talk about an all-American baby face. I mean, that is the great white hope right there. Hey, I just defended the heavyweight championship of the world, but, you know, I got to go in to save lives as a fireman like a couple of days later. I mean, that is just like you couldn't write that.
No, you couldn't. He is absolutely the face of MMA, for sure. When you've got your good guys and your bad guys, he is the number one face. And it's largely just because he's a real dude in his hometown. It's largely because of his schedule. He doesn't bend from the schedule.
Yeah, take that, you know, in comparison to like Conor McGregor, you know, with like custom made suits and Bentleys and flashy and look at me and, you know, like can't do anything without making it a completely outrageous kind of endeavor, which is a great place to be if you can do it right, and you have to be able to do it right. You're another example of that. It's there's nothing more painful than when you watch a guy half-assed try to do that character. When you watch a guy who's obviously a fan of like a Ric Flair type of character and wants to sort of portray himself in that light, but just doesn't quite commit to it. You did it. Connor did it. I haven't seen anyone else come down the pike since then who's even showing glimpses of it at this point. But you have to be able to commit 100% to get that persona right. But if you take a guy like that, it's a perfect, the perfect, you know, yang to that yin, if you like, is a Stipe character where he's just like an everyman, you know, totally big square jaw, you know, just you know, kissing babies, shaking hands, saving lives, you know, fighting for his family. I mean, that is you can't make a better babyface character than that.
You couldn't write it. No, if you were Vince, you would create an angle where the dude's the baddest dude in the world and works at the fire department. It would be a work. It doesn't happen in real life. This guy's actually the champion, and he's at the fire department right now waiting to save lives. That's a shoot, and it's truly unbelievable.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Let me ask you real quick.
Okay.
Just while we're talking about heels and baby faces, you obviously made your money, or you know, made your mark in your career as a heel. Let me ask you this, and I certainly don't mean to you know, to desensitize you know, the unfortunate things that you've had in your personal life as of late. But to me, when you were talking about training earlier, it made me think of that tweet that you put out where you were carrying the tire. I think it was a tire. You were doing a fireman's carry, I think. You had your little boy walking. It honestly, Chael, like I'm not just saying this, you know, to kiss your ass. Like, you know, we're friends. I was in tears. Like I'm getting a little choked up just thinking about it now, because I love the fact that you referenced Scott Hall's go home line from his Hall of Fame speech. You know, which I'm sure a lot of MMA fans probably don't realize. But I just went. I showed it to Mickey, and Mickey did the same thing where Mickey was, you know, she was just like, wow, look at that. You know, and we were just so choked up, you know, because obviously I have a little boy and, you know, he'd been in the gym with me a couple of days earlier, you know, doing like similar kind of stuff where he was kind of trying to copy what I was doing. And it was just this unbelievable sort of feeling. And then we sort of composed ourselves and I said, well, I guess Chael's a baby face now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But yeah, man, I'll tell you, I've had a rough month. It's been a rough little storm, but I tell you, I don't know any way around those things. You got to go through them sometimes, and it's so hard to get out of bed when you're depressed and when you're sad and when you're dealing with that stuff. But at the same time, when that clock goes off, man, you got to get up. That's just what you just have to do it. And I mean, that's about all I can tell you about my month, man. It's been a rough month, but the only way around it is to go through it. And there's just not going to be any other way.
That's wonderful advice, you know, from a guy who's obviously been so successful. But you didn't answer my question. Do you think if you come back, do you think you're going to get a babyface reception? Or are you going straight back to the bad guy?
I would go straight back to the bad guy.
I figured you would say that.
Yeah, if I came back and got any positive response from the fans, I would flip it right then. I would say I can see you guys have all missed me, but let me make this really clear. I haven't missed a single one of you, and all I've done in the last 2 years is think of new ways to scheme you out of your money, and you're all going to be contributing to my favorite charity known as the Chael Sonnen Bank Account. And I would leave it at that. I would set the pace right out of the gate if I was to come back. But I don't want anything to do. I don't even want anything to do with that good guy part. All those guys want patted on the backs, but I don't want anything to do with it.
You want money. I want money in the bank.
I want that. I want to draw. I want to give them something to be entertaining, and every story needs a bad guy. I love the movies. I only have a few hobbies, and watching movies is one of them, and there's got to be a bad guy. There just does.
Hey, who influenced your bad guy persona? I'm just curious. Obviously you've got your own spin on it, but where's a lot of the inspiration coming from for that?
Well, yeah, I really like Scott Hall's work. You brought him up. I thought he was great, but I just like the guys that embraced it, that went all the way in. You know, one of the greatest heels of all time was Ted DiBiase. I used to hate that son of a bitch. Oh God, did I hate
Unbelievable.
Him. And I'll tell you another guy, he might be number one. It's probably between Ted and I'll tell you who is Rick Rude. And the thing with Rick Rude is how unapologetic he was about being a dick. And, you know, some of these guys, I'll watch them, they'll go for a little bit of heel heat. When the crowd reacts, all of a sudden, you know, they got to give a smile or give a wink, or they start to go down that road and they stop partway. And Rick Rude went all the way, and he never broke. And, you know, I would say those guys were, you know, those were the ones. And
I definitely see Rick Rude in the way you talk. I definitely see some Rick Rude. I see a little bit of Nick Bockwinkel too.
He was good. Nick was very good. Nick was a little ahead of his time. You know, against superstar Billy Graham, it all kind of stems from him. Muhammad Ali, if you want to get into that. Superstar said he was influenced by Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali said he was influenced by some golfer.
Well, Muhammad Ali was—he would publicly say he was influenced by Gorgeous George, but privately, the opinion is that he was influenced by a lesser-known wrestler called Sweet Daddy Siki, who was a black wrestler who he was a territories guy, but he had some good success up in Calgary for Stu Hart and a few other promoters. But the word is, I don't know how much validity there is to it, but the word is he was influenced by Sweet Daddy Siki.
Wow. And see, I love those stories like that. And, you know, Superstar, to go back to him, he was just a little bit ahead of his time. He was just with the colors and some of the stuff he was doing, it was weird. And then about a decade later, it became the way to do it.
Hogan ripped him off completely, and so did Jesse Ventura.
Yeah, straight, both of those guys ripped him off completely. And I hope that they would admit it. You know, I like it when a guy admits it. There's nothing wrong with being influenced. For a minute there, Scott Hall had resentment for me. And it was like, and I met him one time at a WrestleMania post-fight party, and I kind of explained it just real fast. I only had about 30 seconds to talk to him, but it's like, hey, man, this is a tip of the hat. This was meant for you to find out and then be flattered by it, not to look at this guy and go, oh, he's ripping me off. And, and then, you know, if I could do it right, I would have called him and asked him first. I borrowed a catchphrase from Len Denton, and I reached out to him first. I didn't know how to get to him, so I went through Roddy Piper, who called Lynn, who said, hey, if it works for you, kid, take it and run with it. Have it all. So, you know, if I could have done it right, I would do it that way. But it's always been, I see guys trying to copy me or try whatever it is, and it's like, good for you. And I love your spin and the way you go with it and steal from each other. We're not reinventing the wheel here. If you see something that works, take it.
Yeah, Flair is a perfect example of a guy who completely acknowledged that he borrowed a huge amount from Dusty, a huge amount from Billy Graham, a huge amount from Terry Funk, and then a plethora of other guys. You know, and he got woo from Jerry Lewis. You know, he was said he was like driving down the road one day, and he heard Jerry Lewis, and he was like, "Cool, woo!" You know, so it's like it doesn't matter because ultimately you're Ric Flair.
Yeah,
you know, you can tell the truth about where it came from. It people like to hear that often.
Yeah, and Dusty Rhodes, who rest his soul, was out there working with the up and coming guys. You know, he would tell these guys, find a character, and it doesn't need to be in wrestling. Go watch movies. Go watch television. Anybody that stands out. Take ideas from him, and you know that's what Stone Cold did. Stone Cold got it all from this guy called the Iceman, and who was actually a serial killer who I don't want to reference in some good light, but Stone Cold's talked about it and been really open and said, you know, that guy was just so bad. He was so damn bad. That's the way I'm going to go with it. He came out, he hated the good guys, and he hated the bad guys. No one had done that before. Everybody picked a side. He hated them all.
Yeah. Well, and in many ways, that's almost really how you were as well. I mean, I don't really ever recall you doing anything in particular to rile up the fans, as, you know, by saying like, "I want everyone to shut up." You know, it was 90% of your rhetoric was always aimed at your opponent. You know, it was you were very articulate, which immediately makes you a heel. That's what made me think of Nick Bockwinkel for you, was how articulate you were when you would sit there and go, "I will systematically pick him apart one punch at a time." And I was like, "God, that's just like Nick Bockwinkel."
Nick was good, man. I appreciate you bringing Nick up.
Yeah, man, you know, you reminded me a lot of it, particularly when you would do the press conferences, because a lot of these guys would do the press conferences, and, you know, unless you're like a Nick Diaz and have like a sort of innate charisma about one-word responses, most of the time, they don't work, and they're boring as shit. You lose me. You know, when someone goes like, "Oh, you know, what do you think about going over?" "Oh, well, we'll see on Saturday night when he possess." You know, and you kind of go, "Great, thanks a lot, buddy." But you would sit there and you know, and that's another reason why McGregor has taken what you did and you know and done it well and become such a huge moneymaker as well, because he's able to articulate and say things on a different level that make people listen. When you talk in a different way, people have to listen. You also did, you know, something smart where you didn't always, it wasn't always completely outrageous and loud, which, I mean, obviously the press conference environment sort of lends itself well to that. But in general, you know, that's something that I learned from Jake the Snake, where he said, you know, if you talk quiet, people have to listen. You know, whereas if you're shouting the whole time, people can sort of develop this filter where it's just like, "Yeah, great. Yeah. You're going to be there. You're going to kick a guy's ass and that's the end of it. All right, cool." Whereas if you speak quietly and you say something slightly differently, like, "I'm going to mess with his mind," suddenly it's like, "The hell's this guy?" You know, he's working on a totally different level. And I saw all of that with you. And like we touched on before, because you were in an environment where you really had no competition on the mic, you stood out and you took the huge chunk of that market share. Fair play to you.
I appreciate that. Thank you, buddy. And yeah, you know, I heard Jake Roberts say that same thing, and he said it post career. I never caught on that was what he was doing. And he went back and he talked about that. And he said, you know, I realized if I talked like this, the people really had to listen or they'd miss it. And I thought, oh my God, I never knew that was a well thought out. You know, he's a very smart guy for being such a knucklehead. Jake Roberts, as far as the psychology goes, he gets it.
When people talk about the line between genius and insanity, I mean, that, you know, you can't get a much more clear definition of it than Jake, because I promoted one of Jake's comedy events not that long ago. We had him do a show up in Richmond. We had a venue that we had a relationship with, and we promoted one of Jake's unspoken word shows, and it was great. The place was full, and you know, he was wonderful to deal with, and it was just, you know, for me, just getting to ride around in the car with him, you know, plus we made some money, which was great, but the real benefit was just being, you know, for me, getting to ride around in the car with him as a fully fledged adult now, because I my first ever show actually was on a card with Jake the Snake Roberts. I was in a battle royal. It was like my first ever pro wrestling show. But I was, you know, 17 years old, like, you know, skinny, pale, like, you know, totally wet behind the ears. So I was just kind of like, "Hello, Mr. Roberts." You know, and that was about that was the extent of our conversation. But, you know, now, obviously, having had a degree of success and notoriety in the business, I was looking forward to getting to sit with Jake and kind of discuss things with him on a different level. And it was so great. I mean, that's a guy who should absolutely be lending his expertise to the next generation.
Yeah, yeah. If he could hold it together, he'd have a place behind the scenes, and I hope he does. All right, Nick, I'm looking at the time, man. We should call it. You got anything else you want to get off your chest?
No, man, absolutely. No, absolutely great. Thank you very much, Chael. It's been awesome as usual.
Oh, this was a blast. I appreciate it. Thanks for tweeting it, man. I appreciated having the questions, too. That was fun, buddy.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, cool. Take care, Nick.
Yeah,
all right,
too.
Guys. Nick Aldis right there. He flipped the script on me. I was getting interviewed there. What a fun guy. Very nice guy. And a guy that really does understand it. I like how he was breaking down the business side of things. Understanding that, because that's what drives it all forward. If you want to get over on that side of the curtain, you got to understand how the other side of the table works. You just have to in that industry. And he's such a smart guy. I love having him on. I learn something every time I talk with him. Guys, here's what you do. You're probably listening to this podcast on a smartphone right now. If you're on any smartphone, Android, iPhone, just go in your search engine, type in TrueCar, download the app, totally free. You'll never pay for anything. If you're looking for a car, I don't care if it's new or used, you can now get it through transparency. The virtual world has made the car buying experience transparent. Go build the car you want virtually. Type in the make, model, the year, mile range, the color, whatever you want to do to the car. CD player, power seats. Put in your zip code. It will show you what people in your area paid for that exact same car. You take that down to any TrueCar certified dealership. Guys, there's over 11,000 of them in the country. Very easy to find. They will honor that price. That's it. It will save you time. It will save you money. Most people are saving almost $4,000. Off of the MSRP. Okay, my buddy TJ right here in Molalla, Oregon, bought himself a Platinum Edition F-150 and saved almost $4,000 off the MSRP. It's that simple. And above everything, you save time. No more falling in love with an ad, wanting that car, looking up the Blue Book value, trying to get yourself all boned up on the info before you go in and sit down. Go in there ready. Show them your app. They'll honor the price. You're done. Get your weekends back. You're at a desktop, www.truecar.com. But go get the app today, whether you're looking for a new car now, and by new, it can be new or used. If you're looking to get yourself a car now, or you're looking later, eventually you're going to be looking, whether it's for you, for it's that kid that's turning 16, whether it's for your wife that's been hounding you, go get yourself the app today. Thank me later. We are out of time. Have a great weekend, everybody. Until next Wednesday, when we all get to meet again, I'm Chael Sonnen, and you are welcome.
Thanks for listening to You're Welcome with Chael Sonnen. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.